bless you, son. Where are you going then, Lol? Take us with you, Lol.
God bless.
The stooping figure of my mother, waist deep in the grass and caught there like a piece of sheep's wool, is the last I see of my country home as I leave it to discover the world. She stands old and bent at the top of a bank, silently watching me go, one gnarled red hand raised in farewell and blessing, not questioning why I go. At the bend of the road, I look back again and see the gold light die behind her. Then I turn the corner, pass the village school, and close that part of my life forever.
As I Walked Out One Midsummer Morning by Laurie Lee, dramatized for radio by Christopher Dennis, with music by Chris Leslie.
It's a bright Sunday morning in early June 1934. I'm 19 years old and carry a small rolled-up tent, a violin and a blanket, a change of clothes, a tin of treacle biscuits and some cheese, and I'm going to London, leaving behind the arms of the local girls.
Stay here, Law. Stay here and marry me.
No, I can't. I'm going to London.
What do you want to go to London for? What's in London if you can't find me?
And as I've never seen the sea, I'll walk to the coast first and find it.
Law.
Down through Wiltshire I go, burning my roots behind me, coming through Malmesbury and Chippenham, and already noting different shades of speech. I pass down the Wylie Valley and come out on a vast and rolling plain, which looks as though it's just been cropped by mammoths, and I'm unprepared for the delicate spire that rises suddenly out of the empty plain, Salisbury, on market day. The pubs are bursting with dealers counting money. Shepherds and dogs sit around on the pavements, and supreme above all towers the misty cathedral, still prince of the horizontal town, throwing its slow shifting shade across the market square. I ride to Southampton, where, after sleeping in fields for a week, I think I'll try a bed again, in a doss house down by the docks.
Chill in the night, money in advance. One glass of whiskey thrown in. If you want more, it's threepence a top. Bucket of water there for your wash. What ship you from?
I've come from Stroud.
Never heard on it. Foreign ship, like as not. Musical fella, though, eh? Hey, diddle diddle, I reckon. Plays the fiddle, do you? Yeah. Much money in it?
I don't know. I'm about to find out.
I wander about for an hour, feeling as though I'm about to commit a crime. I stop at last under a bridge near the station and decide to have a go. I draw the violin from my coat like a gun. Once part of the hurrying crowds, I now stand nakedly apart, my back to the wall, my hat on the pavement before me, the violin under my chin. I'm neither arrested nor told to shut up. Indeed, nobody takes any notice at all. Then, an old man, without stopping, surreptitiously tosses a penny into my hat. Other pennies follow. Slow melodies are the best. The people dawdle. Irish jigs send them whizzing past. Old ladies are the most generous. And women with children.
Dear gentlemen, give this penny to the poor young man.
Here's a penny for you, poor young man.
And so along the coast through Chichester and Bognor to Worthing, Cheltenham-on-Sea. And from here I head north for London. I am T.E. Lawrence, engaged in some self-punishing odyssey, burning up my youth, eyes narrowing to the sandstorms blowing out of the wadis of Godalming in a mirage of solitary endurance.
Here! I'm going north, is you?
For a couple of days, I have a companion, as I'm picked up by a veteran tramp.
Al. Name of Al.
He's about 5 feet high and clearly one of the Brotherhood. He wears a deerstalker hat so sodden and shredded it looks like a helping of breakfast food. And round the waist of his Macintosh hangs a collection of pots, pans, cans and ladles.
Name of Elf?
Laurie.
Ah, it's a daft name. Can't be having that. You're an Alf and all. Ah, us on the road. We're all Alfs.
In fact, he never mentions anybody who isn't called Alf.
Do you know what? An Alf, I'm you. Used to do 20 miles a day. One of the looniest Alfs on the road. Said he got round it quicker. And he did. But folks got sick of his face. Takes me a year to get down my route. Move into me own timetable. Winter time, I holes up in a doss house in London. Then I'm the spring tramp in the Midlands, the summer bird of the south, and the first touch of autumn to the Kentish Weald. Does them good, see? To see me turning up same time, same season, year after year, reassuring, like the seasons themselves. Now then, I goes this way, Alf. You goes that.
And he rattles out of my life, looking very small and triangular with his pointed hat on his head and black Macintosh trailing the ground. I see London, a long, smoky skyline hazed by the morning sun and filling the whole of the eastern horizon. No architectural glories, no towers or palaces, just a creeping, insidious presence. It's vast, horizontal, broken here and there by a gas holder or factory chimney. Cleo, my girlfriend, is somewhere in there, waiting.
Laurie, I knew it. I knew you'd come. Look, Daddy, look who's here.
I met Cleo in the spring, in a Tolstoyan settlement near Stroud, where she was living in a borrowed caravan, together with her handsome father and well-born mother. They recently fled from America, where I suspect the father was in some sort of political trouble. She is 16, with huge brown eyes flecked like crumbled honey, a smooth, leggy figure, lithe as an Indian pony. And we're in love.
We're completely penniless just now, but we've been lent this very grand house.
It looks like it's been hit by a bomb.
I know. It's being knocked down about our ears so they can build a block of horrible flats for capitalists. But how did you get here?
Walked.
You walked it? I told you, Daddy. I have all your letters. I keep them in my room, wrapped up in my nightdress. I'll show you later.
Beautiful Cleo. She will never know what she does to me as she leads me through that ruined garden, her eyes slanting under the myrtle leaves, her coiled russet limbs like something from a Rousseau jungle.
You will join the party, won't you? I must have the movement. You do understand, don't you?
Her lovely mouth is a political megaphone, but not a word of what I want to hear. Never a word about love or my hunger or the summer night, leaving me in considerable torment.
Hey, Laurie. You must go back and get all the farm workers in Slad to collectivize and unionize. Elsewhere would they be when the revolution comes?
After some days of this, I make one last try. I fetch one of the builder's ladders and climb through her bedroom window.
Cleo!
Your daddy knew about this. He'd murder you.
It's no idle figure of speech. I don't know what she told him, but he's given me an address of some lodgings and got me a job on another building site. A reasonable compromise between new thought and the horsewhip. And so I become a builder's labourer at £2.5 a week.
Here. What's your name, mate? Chuck us over that whatchacallit, will you? Got to make a what's it for this thingamajig. Where are you from?
Slab.
Well?
Slad, in this road.
Never heard of it. Most of us here is Wandsworth folk or Fulham.
Yeah, and them fellas with the pale skin has been guests of His Majesty too recent.
Buckingham Palace.
Buckingham Palace. Lord, how green.
Brixton Palace, more like.
Or the Scrubs.
Hell yeah. Oh, I've got all sorts here, I tell you.
safe breakers, catmen, dopers.
Look out. Look lively. Here comes the foreman. What do I do?
You stick with us, son. Grab yourself a barrow. Look busy.
Right. You've got things sorted out, have you?
I live in a ground floor room in a squat Victorian villa, and my landlady is Mrs. Flynn, a valiant blonde with something of the twilight beauty of Gloria Swanson.
You must see all of London while you're here, Laurie. Why not take a trip out to Richmond at the weekend to see the deer? They're wearing their beautiful antelopes at this time of the year. That's a picture of my husband there. Do you see? On the mantel. That's Mr. Flynn. Though Gould knows where he's run off to. Never marry, Laurie. I was married far too young. It's a terrible mistake. I was far too impressive. It's just that, well, I like men with those thick lips, you know. You know, the curling rosebud type. I always think they look so essential, you know, sort of Russian looking. No, I expect it's different in Russia now, since the revulsion.
When I'm ill, she looks after me, reduces the rent, and brings me bottles of Guinness.
That Laurie, no wonder he goes poorly like that. He burdens his brain too much.
One morning in early spring, when the flats are nearly finished, something happens which throws us all together.
Here, I've just seen them.
What? Seen what?
Some non-union men.
There's no non-union labour here, mate.
There is, I tell you. The manager just smuggled them onto the site on the Q team.
Why? We know what to do about that.
Come on, lads! Come on, me beauties! One out, all out! Solidarity! Come on, lads! Down tools!
The strike lasts 2 weeks, during which I taste the first sweet whiff of revolution. Meeting in cafes and basements, drawing up manifestos, planning demonstrations, painting placards and posters, I begin to experience hallucinations of communism, to see visions of the day when the workers will triumph, the bosses in flight, the temples of privilege falling, others joining us to inherit a scrubbed new world of open-necked shirts, bare arms flexed in common labor. Perhaps a hint of free love with our prettier comrades. Then, as if it never happened, the strike is over, and we're back at work dodging the foreman and gambling in corners. I've been nearly a year in London. The flats are almost completed, and I'll soon be out of a job. I'll be penniless but free, and can just pack up and walk away. So, where shall I go? France? Italy? Greece? Somewhere or other, I've picked up a phrase in Spanish for, will you please give me a glass of water? So, that clinches it. I shall go to Spain. It's early, and still almost dark when our ship reaches the harbour, and I'm simultaneously woken and hooked to the coast of Spain by the rattling anchor going over the side. I rise with the Spanish sun, and for the first time in my life, I see, looped around the bay, the shape of a foreign city. Vigo seems to rise from the sea like some rust-corroded wreck, as old and bleached as the rocks around it. No smoke, no movement among the houses. Everything looks barnacled, rotting, and deathly quiet, as though awaiting the return of the flood. I am in Spain, and a new life is beginning. I have a few shillings in my pocket, and no return ticket. I have a knapsack, a blanket, a spare shirt, and a fiddle, and enough words to ask for a glass of water. So I set off on my way. The sea shines white behind me. The rising hills before me go stepping away inland, fiercely shaped under the great blue sky. I shoulder my burden, and avoiding the road, I take a track southeast for Zamora. The days merge into a continuous movement of sun and shadow, hunger and thirst, fatigue and sleep, all fused and welded into one colored mass by the violent heat of the Spanish summer. I walk through rich fields of copper earth, with violent outcrops of poppies running in blood-stained bandanas across acres of rasping wheat. I'm burnt by the sun and bug-ridden from the inns, but I'm also beginning to pick up the language.
Look at the foreigner.
Look at the Frenchman.
English, I'm English.
Come this way, foreigner.
This way?
We'll take to the inn.
An evening village in the drowsy grip of harvest. Women and girls in broad hats and veils, looking as mysterious as Minoan dancers, stand in graceful circles, winnowing the grain in the wind, tossing and catching it in drifts of gold, gilded from head to foot with chaff.
Don Maria, look! They've brought a Frenchman!
Don Maria, look at him!
Thank you. Oh, come in, come in. You poor young man, and welcome. Sit down here and rest. You look half starved. Sit down, sit down. I'll get you some food.
Oh, thank you. Ah, what have we here?
Oh, he comes from somewhere away. Some poor devil who's walking the world.
Ah, looks done in to me. Here, Frenchman.
Oh, I'm English.
Drink this. Ah, drink plenty. Give me this fancy for walking.
Do you want to sleep here tonight?
Well, I have very little money. How much?
Oh, I charge very little money for a straw sack, 2 pennies.
Oh, well, good. Well, I'll sleep with you.
Oh, no. You'll sleep on the sack.
At the end of the day, the doors and windows admit all the creatures of the family. Father, son, daughter, cousin, the donkey, the pig, the hen. Even the harvest mouse and the nesting swallow bed together at the fall of darkness.
Hey, see the fiddle? Music! Give us some music!
Oh, yes, man, come, divert us a little, entertain us, touch us a little tune.
Right.
I tear drunkenly into an Irish reel. They listen open-mouthed, unable to make head nor tail of it. I might have been playing a Tibetan prayer wheel. Then I try a woozy fandango which I picked up along the way, and comprehension jerks them into life. The woman leaps to her feet and starts stamping the ground, raising great clouds of dust around me. Not to be outdone, the old man leaves the shadows, strikes a posture and faces the woman. Donna Maria, all flesh, he thin as a straw. Together, they begin a dance of merciless contest.
Come on, you old bogey!
Hey, not so old, I can't help that, you! Not so old, neither!
It's no longer just a moment of middle-aged horseplay. The old man dances as if his life was at stake, while the woman is suddenly transformed, her great lumpen body becoming a thing of controlled and savage power. She stamps and postures round her small hopping husband as if she would tread him into oblivion. While the dance lasts, she is a woman, unsheathed and terrible.
Poor old lungs, I can't breathe. That's it, no more.
Oh, Mother of God. Oh, Mother of God, help me. This is not for an old woman. Oh, my bones ache.
Egyptian.
Right, enough now. Sleep, you stranger. You sleep there. Good night, stranger.
Good night.
The fowls roost in the rafters. The old man lies fast asleep on the floor with a goat tethered to his ankle. The room's stifling, but the straw is soft. And here I sleep, my head roaring with Spain. The wheat plain of Zamora is my first taste of Spanish heat. The brass-taloned lion which licks the afternoon ground, ready to consume anyone not wise enough to take cover. The height of the wheat around me restricts the view to only a few yards, so that I'm quite unprepared for the sudden appearance of Toro, an ancient, eroded, red-walled town spread along the top of a huge, flat boulder and looking like dried blood on a rusty sword. I'm ready to find it deserted or to see some Pompeii-like waste long blasted by doom. But on the contrary, half ruined though it certainly is, the town is buzzing with life. Huge banners and shawls swing from the balconies, all decorated in Grand Guignol fashion, some stitched with black crosses, others tied at the corners with gigantic bows of black crepe. Townsfolk and stove-hatted peasants from the plain are crowding the pavement, some with small buttoned cushions to kneel on. The multitude is fixing its eye on the distant church. A heap of gold at noon, it's now a dark blue shadow hanging in the air like a wisp of incense. The doors are thrown open onto a sparkling darkness, like a cave full of summer fireflies. As several hundred candles stream away from the altar and flutter into the street. The spectators fall to their knees as though sprayed with bullets. Is it the death of their saint they are so lugubriously celebrating with their black banners and dripping candles? Her image comes riding high in the heart of the procession, a glittering figure of painted wood, bobbing her crowned head stiffly left and right to the kneeling crowds in the gutters. Her bearers sweat under their jeweled load, grunting patiently into their lacy shirt fronts. I see her face as she draws level, rose-tinted, pretty as a sugared sweet, with a smooth head perched on a little doll-like body, heavily tinted in robes of velvet. Whoever she was, this prim painted mannequin, she dominates the town with an undeniable presence, and as she passes, she seems to trail behind a gigantic swathe of absolution. Clearly she's the living saint, sister of the Virgin, intimate of Christ, eternal mediator with the ghost of God, and compassionate mother of Toro. She leaves behind a smell of wax, burnt wicks and exhaustion. Then everyone's nodding and smiling at one another. The solemn wake is over, and the streets fill with promenaders spreading from wall to wall. I wander invisibly among them, submerged by their self-absorption, and suddenly find myself wishing for a face I know, for Stroud on a Saturday night. Toro is deserted when I leave, sweltering in one of the hottest days of the Spanish summer. Fantasies of water rise and wrap me in cool, wet leaves. I see the steamy, damp-uddered cows of home, planting their pink lily mouths in the brook. I hear my mother, in her summer kitchen, splashing water on garden salads, and hear the gulping gush of the garden pump. Then, through the blur, I see the spire of a church rising from the plain like the jet of a fountain. There's a sudden shower of eucalyptus trees brushing against the roadside tavern, and I'm at the bar.
A drink. Quick, water. One of them bottles of pop.
No, 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 you mustn't drink. You'll fall down dead. Help the young man. Help him.
French? German?
English. Oh, the lady's right. You're too hot for drinking.
He'll drop dead at our feet. Just look at his face.
Sit here.
Rest and cool off.
Where have you come from? Vigo.
Where are you going?
Valley of Leith, Segovia, Madrid.
On foot? The man's mad. It's idiotic not to be thought of.
You should give up this stupid walking, you young idiot.
Right. Give the young man a little to drink now.
Here.
If he lives and still wishes to go to the city, we'll take him in the car.
Later. Much later, I'm lifted to my feet and half-led, half-carried outside. Then, stretched fast asleep in the back of the car, I'm driven like a corpse to Valladolid, where it's time for me to make some money.
Good morning. You're lost, perhaps?
I'd like to see the mayor.
So would I. So would all the world.
Was he away?
Yes, he's away. Well away. He's in the madhouse.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, don't be. No, not at all. He's very happy. Who wouldn't be in such a place? There biscuits and chocolate at all hours of the day, nuns to talk to and coloured wool to play with. Yeah, at least so they say. But you see me here, and if I can help...
I'm a musician, a fiddler. Huh? I'd like a license, a permit to play in the streets for money.
How charming. Rumpty-dumpty-diddly-yay, eh? But of course you should have a license. Just a moment. Manola! Please! What? Yeah, find me a license, please, Manolito.
License? What kind of license?
Oh, any kind. Only make it a nice one for such a pleasant young man.
All right, license one, then. Then pardon me, Don Ignacio.
Yes. And shift your feet from the filing cabinet.
Yes, be my guest. License to sell water, to erect a small tomb, to beat gold, to press juniper berries. Here we have it, I do believe, Don Ignacio.
The very one. And very nice. Oh, very decorative. One of the prettiest. Well, come along. My pen.
Yeah, Don Ignacio.
And there. The city is yours. Rumpty-dumpty-dilly-dum, eh?
It's a very fine license. It's like a royal charter. It looks very expansive.
Not at all. Half a peseta. Or you could join me in a game of chess.
According to my experience in England, money should now be dropped into the hat. But it isn't. Everybody stops what they're doing and gathers round, blocking the traffic, blotting out the sun and treading my new hat into the ground. A policeman appears.
Hey, you! Police! What do you think you're doing?
Just playing some music.
License?
Yes. Here.
Oh. Hey, there's no money in your hat.
No.
What's the matter with you all? Either pay up or clear up out of it.
I'm not too happy with his support, as he holds the crowd back with his guns. But now there's money in the hat, and nobody tramples a hat with money in it. There are certain places one leaves never expecting to see again, and I don't ever wish to return to that city. Outside Segovia, I find the little church of the local Virgin, a macabre memorial lying at the foot of the desolate Cliff of Crows. This granite rock, smothered with croaking birds, is also Segovia's Cliff of Blood. From here, the city has been in the habit of tossing into the gorge its felons, adulterers, and heretics. According to the priest,
the slain all belong to the world of the damned, you see, my son. The crows, you see, are the ghosts of their godless souls. The heroine of this place is Maria del Salto. In the 13th century, a beautiful Jewess accused of adultery. She called upon the Virgin to prove her innocence and was compassionately halted while still in midair and allowed to float unhurt to the ground. The little church was built to commemorate the miracle, though the guilty were still brought here to perish.
It gives me the shivers, and I travel on to Madrid, where I do well. People walk from the shops to give me an apple or orange, and women throw paper-wrapped gifts from the balconies. Mornings in the Posada are the best time of day, with the walls dripping with watered flowers. I sit in the doorway while a girl, Concha, squats on the bench beside me and starts pinning and curling her hair.
You'll see, Lowry. When my boyfriend comes back, he'll bring wonderful gifts. Jam, butter, wonderful. We'll have a feast, if he returns.
She's a husky young widow in her ripe middle 20s, mature and beautiful, though well out of reach of my years. Her heavy gold hair looks like a load of straw, and would look even better if she dyed it more often.
Why are you alone, Lowry? Don't you have a wife? Or a picnic? So handsome, young, and alone. Not right. Hold out your hand. Here. Fish oil. I want you to massage my hair with it. Make it sleek and glossy.
And I'm content to sit out the morning at this indolent task, feeling her body lean against me, heavy and silent, oblivious to the passing cries of the carters.
Your clothes, Lowry, are without class or dignity. They're not proper for an Englishman. What you need, at the very least, is a new pair of trousers. I'll get some for you from a gentleman I know. You'll have them tonight, I promise you. Then you'll be able to walk in the streets with honour.
I have killed more fools than anyone in here.
In the evening, I do very well with the fiddle and spend the rest of the night in the bars and cafe brothels, crowded with gypsies, touts and lechers, and youths gazing aghast at the girls in the windows, without the money to buy them. The bar is voluptuously furnished, and decorated throughout with a Victorian amalgam of blood and sex. Varnished posters on the walls, the colour of old smoked salmon, announce Toros en Valencia, 1911. The wine is poured from a great stone jar and served by an old man who lost a leg in the bullring.
The bullring? Gone to rack and ruin.
I walk back through the streets with a rocking head, long past midnight. For once, Madrid seems deserted. As I stumble upstairs, a hand touches mine in the darkness.
Lowry.
And draws me into a jumbled, moonlit room.
I have your clothes, Lowry. From the gentleman. So smart you'll be.
She stands against me, holding my shoulder blades, and I can smell her peppery flesh.
Mm. Man. Handsome young man. So young. And you're here with me. Mama. Shh, little one. Sleep. Come, Lowry.
She takes off my boots and helps me into bed. And before she joins me, she makes the sign of the cross. Two days later, I walk into Toledo, and in the evening, I'm playing an open-air cafe in the plaza, a sloping square of uneven cobbles, and the town's main center, when a special party arrives. There are four of them, a woman in dazzling white, a tall man wearing a broad black hat, a jaunty young girl with a rose in her hair, and a pretty, lacy child. They're clearly not Spanish, yet they have a Spanish air.
Bravo!
Well done!
Here! Thanks.
Are you German?
No, English.
Oh, so am I.
Won't you please join us?
I'll do, young sir. Roy Campbell, South African poet. Reasonably well known in your country, I think I can say. Mind you, I hate England. All my friends are English. English literature, like an unburied corpse. I'm in Spain because England has no manhood anymore.
Oh, Roy.
Are you broke? Can I help you at all? This is my wife, Mary. Our little daughter, Anna, and Amelia, young Catalan friend.
Hello.
It's my husband's saint's day, so we're all dressed up in his honor. How long have you been in Toledo?
Oh, a day and a night.
Are you traveling alone?
Yes, from Vigo.
Do you like risotto?
Very much.
Then I'm sure we have more than enough if you'd care to come home to supper with us.
We've rented a house under the wall of the cathedral. Come with us. Yes. Lots of room.
Supper is served on a patio open to the sky, and I find myself sitting down to a well-laid table for the first time in 2 months.
English artists can't stand them. All pygmies, except John. Do you know John?
John? John who?
No, not John, anybody. Augustus John, finest painter in England, only painter in England. And there's a real man for you. Met him when we were living in France, the south of Vic. Arranged our wedding out there in the wilderness of the Camargue. Full gypsy affair, designed like one of his paintings. Caravans, campfires, ceremonial mixings of blood, contests of strength, and fighting till we, that's Mary and me, mounted on a couple of horses and galloped off across the midnight
Plain, eh? You have to humour Roy. He means well, bless him. In fact, he met me in London, and that's where we were married. Oh. We did spend our honeymoon with the Johns in Dorset. And it's true, there was a loud gypsy party held in a pub near Parkstone.
I was the champion of Martigues, wasn't I, Mary?
You were, Roy.
I could outsail, outrow, outdrink, and outfight them all. And then Mary and me would make love all night.
During most of the daylight hours, Roy lies low and sleeps, appearing at nightfall like some ruffled seabird, leaning against a pillar with his arms stretched wide as though drying his salt-wet wings, and gathering his wits in great gulps of breath, after which he's ready for another.
What do you think of El Greco? Hey, his work.
I don't know anything about him. And I've never seen his work.
Never seen him? Never seen El Greco? You must. Bloody marvellous. Come on, this minute. Look at that. A bloody miracle. That hand. Look at that light in the sky. Pure Toledo. Only he was the first bugger to see it.
And those colors. I've never seen anything like them before.
Yeah. Weeping purples, lime greens, bitter yellows.
Long skulls of the saints and their sunken eyelids. Eyes coated with ecstatic denials.
And the limbs. And faces drawn upwards like spires ascending. See, their robes flickering like tapered flame. Exhausts you, doesn't it?
It does. It exhausts us both. And we spend the rest of the day in bars. I spend my last hours at the Campbell shaking the brandy fumes from my head.
Don't go in the heat.
You don't have to go at all.
Roy takes me down to the bridge which crosses the Tagus.
Good boy, lad. Right, if you get your money, eh? Come back if you want to. We might have gone to Mexico, but we'll always be glad to see you.
From across the bridge, I look back and see him, still standing in the road, legs astride, shoulders hunched. He raises his wide-brimmed hat and holds it high for a moment, then turns and stumbles back into the town. It's the end of September, and I've reached the sea. A man grips my arm.
I don't know who you are, but if you want to see blood, stick around. You're going to see plenty. Plenty of blood. Do you hear me?
I take 5 days to reach Malaga, which is full of foreigners, effeminate Dutch, sandy Germans, Macintosh Frenchmen, and English Debs. The English Debs sit apart, cool as doves in their tennis whites, sipping tea and talking musically of mummy. I wander lazily among them, playing tunes of all nations, and being rewarded with drinks and money. I meet Falter and Schulemid.
We are Jews. From Berlin.
We could not stay, not with things as they are now under Hitler.
We have walked all the way, carrying our child. He's only one.
They are a shadow of the times. They have run to Spain to escape the violence of Germany. Yet here in Spain, there is violence in the very air.
War is coming. We can't escape it. How else will we change anything?
As December closes in, I decide to hole up for the winter at Almuñeca, 60 miles east of Malaga. It's a tumbling little village built of stone steps and almost gloomily Welsh. There are two hotels, one of them run by a Swiss.
You can stay here and work for me. I can give you a room, and you can play your violin in the saloon at night.
Manolo, the waiter from the hotel, handsome as a playboy but moody and idealistic, is my companion of these days. He's the leader of a radical group of fishermen and labourers, into which I'm gradually admitted.
First, there must be death and dissolution. There's much which must be destroyed and cleared away. But no guns. No guns. Guns dishonour the flesh.
Ah, yet we all know. There are plenty of guns here in the village. Plenty that weren't here before.
Life must be clean. If only for the children's sake. But not till all the tyrants have been destroyed and their infection burned from the ground can love and freedom find space to prosper. Don't stop us. They'll bring in the army. We haven't got a chance, Lorenzo. We're going to need the help of all the world.
The election is victory for the socialists!
A popular front, comrades! A people's government at last! Now we'll see the new world!
Little happens at first. Almuñeca, like Spain, is split down the middle.
The fishermen have taken over a boat. What is there to catch? Nothing but a few miserable sardines.
Some peasants a mile from the town have commandeered a patch of land.
What are the owners doing?
Lying low. They sit whispering in the casino.
Ah, yes. See there, peering out through the curtains.
And waiting.
We're all waiting. But for what?
Spring comes with a rush of snow water from the Sierras, which carries a long red stain out to sea. There is an air of carnality, the brief clearing away of taboos which seems to possess the village, a sudden, frank, even frantic pursuit of lust, bred from a sense of impending peril.
Lorenzo, we want you to do something for us.
Yes,
if you can do it, that is.
Of course he can do it. He has legs like a bull. Mountains are nothing to him.
I'll do whatever you want. All we want you to do is to visit a farmer in the hills and deliver a simple message.
Tell him to expect a delivery of
seed potatoes.
Even I know that seed potatoes are code for hand grenades.
You're always walking about. Of course you'll be seen, but nobody will wonder.
The ice plant is sabotaged, and the power station is blown up, both of which belong to a marquis. In spite of the inconvenience, the whiff of dynamite is considered a tonic. A number of shops are looted, some priests are insulted in the street, and a store of wine barrels rolled into the sea.
The church! The church is on fire! Ha ha ha!
Now there are strikes, parades, shows of proletarian force. Each day more peasants come in from the country, massing in the square to be on hand for trouble. Many bring guns, flintlocks, pistols, and old rusty muskets, which might have been saved from the Peninsular War. Men hope that their wives might be freed of the triple trivialities of the church, credulity, guilt, and confession. That their sons might be craftsmen rather than serfs, their daughters citizens rather than domestic whores, and that they might hear the children in the evening come home from fresh-built schools to astonish them with new facts of learning. All this can now be brought about by an act of their elected government and the peaceful process of law. There is nothing to stop it. Except for the powerful minority would rather the country first bled to death. There is violence in Madrid, demonstrations in Valencia, strikes and riots in Barcelona.
Are you going?
Where?
Home to your country.
No.
General Franco, the butcher of the Asturian miners, has flown in from the Canaries to lead the rebels. There's going to be terrible bloodshed.
I've no reason to go. I'd rather stay.
You should go.
The police have disappeared, and the village is on its own.
Arthur Malaga is in flames. Knows. Nobody can tell.
Where are you going?
Where can I go? Look at my car. Look at the bullet holes.
Elegant in their lacy white shirts, the young señoritos are arrested. The priest is rounded up and led off to jail with the others.
There was a plot. Now we'll teach the bastards. Now we'll have them tied like mules.
Here, drink some more brandy. You'll need it for the executions.
No. No executions.
Oh, what's the matter with you? You need fire. Your vengeance is like a trickle of ice water.
Four truckloads of militia drive off to Altafaro to attack the rebels. In their bright blue shirts, waving their caps, some with dynamite, others sharing a musket between three. Once they're over the hill, the morning passes in silence until, about noon, a white aircraft swings in low from the sea, circles the village, and flies away again, leaving the clear blue sky scarred with a new foreboding that the village, thought to be secure and forgotten, had been spied by the eye of war. After nightfall, a destroyer creeps into the bay and sweeps the shore with its searchlight, pinning the village against the darkness. There's nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. Such pitiless brightness has never lit up their night before. Friend or foe, it is a light of terror. Suddenly, a lorry is approaching the village, then another, and another, all packed with men. The beam follows them as though escorting them home. It is El Gato's militia coming back at last. The beam is abruptly switched off. A moment of absolute darkness. Then there comes a blinding flash from the sea. Silence. Then the mountains behind us thunder. A thunder that booms and cannons from peak to peak and tumbles in the valleys like showers of stones. Another flash. Another blast of hot air.
It's a salute! A salute to the militia!
The searchlight comes on again. The crowd surge inland like a muddy wave. The house on our right shudders, rises a foot in the air, and slowly collapses like a puffball. As the village runs for the darkness of the hills, A small boat pulls out from the shore and rows frantically towards the ship.
It's all right. Don't worry. It's nothing.
Nothing? You call that nothing?
Just an unfortunate error of war.
A case of mistaken identity, that's all it was.
The captain thought the militia were attacking the village rather than returning home. He only meant to help.
He sends his apologies.
The apologetic captain slips anchor and sails quietly away, leaving a few gaps in the houses, a few dead in the streets, and most of the population scattered across the hillsides.
And the militia's raid on Otafaro?
Oh, that! A fiasco. A complete fiasco. The men forgot their ammunition.
Now the scarlet banners are everywhere, and the fishermen have taken over the village, commandeering the houses of suspects and the villas of the rich, and painting across them their plans for the new millennium.
Here will be the nursery school. Here will be a sanatorium for women.
This will be the workers' school for agricultural science.
And here will be the training college for girls.
Meanwhile, the militia are massing for a new attack on Otafaro. We watch and listen in silence with a sense of morbid compassion. There's no victory, however. Otafaro is not destroyed, nor does it even surrender. The militia return about midnight, to no singing or cheering. The wounded, the dying, and the dead are unloaded in bitter silence.
Something went wrong.
But the ships, the bombardment...
Oh, useless! The shells fell in open country, in the hills, behind the town.
We've no skills in this. No training, we're useless.
It was a massacre.
We're not proper soldiers.
We need more than courage and anger and all these slogans if we're to go to war.
They blow up the bridges on the coastal road, so that as far as we can tell, we are now cut off.
Manolo!
Manolo has returned!
He walks quietly into the bar like an apparition, his face drawn, his clothes dripping with seawater.
Here, drink this!
I saw you go. I buried myself. Yeah? Isidro was lying just across the alley. He was still alive when they found him. Cut his throat.
Ah. Oh, no! No, Isidro!
When he got quiet, I went into the sea.
Is the bridge down?
Yes. I swam to the Faro, then I came on over the cliff.
What about the ships?
You saw them? You saw what they did?
Can we get back?
Not with this gang. Never. We're finished before we started.
Listen. Angato, Manolo, on the radio. There's word.
Seville has fallen. I am the General Pedro de Llano. Christ has triumphed through God's army in Spain, of which Generalissimo Franco is the sainted leader. I order all workers to submit and to return to work. Otherwise, you and your families will be shot. God's army is merciful, but Spain will be emptied if necessary. Long live Spain! Long live the Virgin!
What can we do? There's nothing to stop them. The war's over, I think.
Next morning, and there is another warship in the bay.
Lorenzo! Lorenzo, hurry!
What? What is it?
Leave everything. You're saved. Your king has sent a ship for you.
They drag me out of the house and hurry me down to the shore.
Run! Run, Lorenzo!
Your friend the Admiral is waiting!
Sure enough, the ship's cutter is drawn up on the sand, guarded by pink-cheeked sailors. A smart officer in white steps forward.
No panic, old chap. The Navy has sent us out from Jib to pick up any British subjects who might be marooned on the coast. Can you be ready in an hour? Situation getting a bit edgy, you know. No place for an Englishman. Personal luggage only, alas.
So it has come. The long arm reaching from home. The destroyer bobbing in the bay like an apron nanny.
The King of England has sent a ship for the Hotel Fiddler.
A large, happy crowd bewails my departure, begging me not to go while lifting me bodily into the boat. And it's over. Finished. The captain welcomes us with a handshake, like a squire at a picnic. The ship leaps into life and slices a sharp curve out to sea. A multi-million pound vessel, throbbing with power, manned by 130 crew, its engines burning fuel at X pounds a minute, and all for an English tramp.
Pre-lunch drinks, old chap. Officer's mess.
But I stay on deck, watching Almunia grow small and Spain fold itself away. The long, hard coast becomes a clinker of bronze on the skyline. Behind it, the peaks of the Sierras hang suspended, then fall away. And in this instant of leaving them, I feel them as never before, clutching at my senses like hands of bone. I see again, as I lose them, the great gold plains. I hear the talk, the cries, the Spanish Arabic voices, the guitars, the songs, all I have known in this country, or have felt without knowing it. Spain drifts away from me, thunder bright on the horizon, and I leave it there beneath its copper clouds.
Here, brought you a drink, old chap.
Thanks.
Shame to break up your holiday like this. I say,
a German airship passes over us and noses inquisitively along the coast, the swastika black on its gleaming hull. To Spain, so backward and so long ignored, the nations of Europe are quietly gathering.
In As I Walked Out One Midsummer Morning by Laurie Lee, the company was Ian Brooker, Alison Carney, Sean Connolly, Janet Dale, Kim Durham, Oliver Jackman, Johan Meredith, Sonny Ormond, Kerry Page, and Amy Schindler. Laurie Lee was played by Jonathan Keeble. The fiddle music was arranged and played by Chris Leslie. As I Walked Out One Midsummer Morning was dramatized by Christopher Dennis, and directed in Birmingham by Peter Leslie Wilde.